Buddhist Summer School, Sunday afternoon, 4th September 1983. Venerable sirs and fellow students, yesterday we stopped at this point. We mentioned that the unitariness of the Absolute Consciousness suffers beclouding as the primordial creative energy puts forth its potentialities into manifestation. Now, whatever name you can give, whatever you can think of, is a potentiality of the origin itself. It's all contained within the origin. And as and when the origin desire is the word used in the old scriptures, to manifest its potentialities, then the whole evolutionary process starts. Now, this word desire is a very interesting word. The verb desiderare, the Latin verb, is made up of de, which means away from, and siderare is associated with the noun sidus, sideris, a star. And remember that a star is a self-shining light, completely illuminated from within itself. Of course, the physical stars are self-illuminated by means of the most terrific atomic explosions taking place constantly. But in the spiritual sense, it means something different. You see, it's a self-shining, it's turning away from the self-shining light is desire. Now, so in the process of evolution, the discriminativeness darkens the clear light. The one whole splits first into two, the self and the not self. There arise the finite and mortal mode of awareness and the infinite eternal, the transcendent mode of awareness. That is where we stopped yesterday. Now, passing through numberless differentiations, we arrive at our own state as it is here and now. On the one hand, we are aware of our cosmos as known to us by our observation and interpretation. This is the vast not-self. On the other hand, our own separate existential being, the particular isolated self, the self to which we refer by using the word I, and all other selves are referred to by using the word you, or the other person, or something like that. You see, the important point is that the unitary wholeness is split up. This is the beginning of sin, if you like. The fundamental meaning, root meaning of the word sin, is whatsoever hurts, breaks up, upsets the unity of the universe. That is the meaning of sin. So we have these two to start with, oneself and the not self, which is the rest of the universe. But at what a price has this happened? With very few exceptions, most of us, the 4,000 millions nowadays on this planet, have quite forgotten the origin, the unitary whole. We are in such darkness that we have no sense of that transcendent clear light, the Absolute Consciousness whence we came. It became an almost blotted out memory, tightly compressed by worldly desires, psychological conflicts, and mental confusions, due to our organic descent, physically, from the primates. Discriminative consciousness became surrounded by a whole host of conditioning and deluding factors, our sankharas. Remember, we started off with that quotation from the Dhammapada. Thus, there is the universal dukkha. All existence is dukkha. All existence is dukkha because the very word existence means a standing out of, existere. You stand out of. What do you stand out of? The unborn, the unmade, the unbecome, and so forth, you see. The transcendent. I use the word transcendent because it is rather more convenient to use one single word than a whole phrase like that. It is not your fault, nor is it my fault, that this has happened. Nor is it the fault of origin. Because the origin, being absolute, is free of anything like consequence. It is just perpetually creative. It's creative energy, and it just creates all along. And there is no question of value or purpose or anything attached to it. That is how it is. And it is precisely our difficulty is to realize, to be able to see that is how it is. If we can sort of begin to sense that in the right way, then so many of our conflicts and difficulties will just vanish away. They will have no meaning because that is how it is. And that is and therefore one sees the importance of understanding exactly what is here and now, if we want to play our part as proper human beings. But this self-same dukkha is one of our powerful saviors. How? Why? Quite simply, and yet most emphatically, it hurts. In so many cases, it hurts like hell. So, we seek to be healed of our ill state. And in this seeking, we awake to another one of our saviors, namely, our power to pay attention correctly and to meditate. And this leads us to know our third and the most powerful Savior right within us, permeating every cell and atom of our being. Dukkha compels us to investigate intelligently and to awaken to the deeper realities of life and smash our fictions about reality. We, as we are constituted, and functioning as we do functioning, are creative energy and absolute consciousness materialized, so to say. In other words, we are transcendence embodied, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, concretized. Each and every existential being is an ill bundle of rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. A sad confection, a sankhara, a perisher bound by the heavy chains of unavoidable conditioning. Each existential being, each one of us, is the prison house of transcendence. What now is our business? It is, not to liberate ourselves, but to liberate transcendence, this imprisoned supernal splendor, by our own utter purification, by our own enlightenment, by the total dissolution of our own isolative and separative selfness. Thus, the liberated transcendence will transcendentally realize itself as the perfect human in each existential being who is void of all evil as long as his organism is alive. We think in terms of liberating ourselves. It's one of the most unfortunate aspects of the urge to live the religious life. If we are capable of looking truly into what is animating us, we shall see it is a self-centeredness on the top floor of the building. That is all. A transcendental self-centeredness, if you like. But nevertheless, self-centeredness. And it is precisely that which produces all the dukkha, not only of ourselves, but of the entire cosmos. So now, recall the Buddha's words in the Dhammapada. Chinda sotam parakamma kame panuda brahmana sankharanam kayam nyatva akatanu si brahmana. And let us translate those lines as follows. O Brahman, work hard. Dry up the stream of craving and dispel all sensuous lusts. Note carefully, all sensuous lusts, because all the sense organs and all the sense impressions are sources of greed, sources of lust, of attachment, and so forth. O Brahman, having realized the waning away of all composite things, thou art the knower of what was never made. That means the transcendent, the unborn, the unbecome, and so forth. Let us now consider, who is the Buddha? What is the Buddha? The Buddha, to whom homage has been paid for over 25 centuries, and rightly paid, that particular source of supreme religious teaching was Siddhartha Gautama, prince of Kapilavastu in his time, who, pierced by the dukkha of all existence, caused by its own existentiality, sought and found deliverance from all ill, became fully self-enlightened, and is evermore the Buddha. The Buddha didn't die. Siddhartha Gautama died. But Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, the two are one, actually, ever since. That is a permanent influence. Because with Sammāsambodhi, mind you, I accept responsibility for saying this. This is my own view. With Sammāsambodhi, there is the functioning of the context of the infinite and the eternal. The context of the unborn, the unbecome, etc. See? And that never ceases. It never began. It never ceases. It is undying. It is eternity realized. And the Buddha, through the mouth of Siddhartha, unequivocally proclaimed, this comes in the Digha Nikaya, the third volume, in the Aggannya Sutta. He's speaking to Vasettha, and he says, Vasettha, these are names tantamount to Tathagata. The Dhamma Kayo, the Brahma Kayo, and again the Dhamma Bhuta, the Brahma Bhuto. This is what he says to Vasistha. So the Buddha is himself the Dhamma body, the Brahma body. He is the incarnate Dhamma, the incarnate Brahma. He says to the dying bhikkhu Vakkali, this comes in the third volume of the Sanyutta Nikaya. Vakkali was very ill, he was dying, and he longed to see the Blessed One before he died. And he couldn't move, so he sent a message, and the Buddha came to him personally and saw him and had a little conversation. And then he said, Vakkali, you must have some worry, you must have something you regret. And Vakkali says, for a long time, Lord, I have been longing to set eyes on the Exalted One, but I had not strength enough in this body to come to see the Exalted One. Hush, Vakkali. What is there in seeing this vile body of mine? He who seeth the Dhamma, O Vakkali, he seeth me. He who seeth me, Vakkali, he seeth the Dhamma. What is this me? Is it the body which was named Siddhartha Gautama? Just that body? Yes, and something infinitely more. So, when he says that to Vakkali, we can see that the invisible, incomposite Buddha, the invisible, incomposite Buddha is manifest in the visible, compounded organism named Siddhartha Gautama. But the two, the Buddha and Siddhartha Gautama, are one. Brahma is the absolute. It is identical with the Upanishadic Brahma, Brahman. And he is identical with the Dhamma, which he himself says is Sanantana, Akalika, eternal, not of time. It's completely out of the context of the finite, temporal, and the mortal. The Buddha, who identified himself with Dhamma and Brahma, expressly declares that he teaches the same Dhamma which was taught by his predecessors. This comes in the first volume of the Digha Nikaya, in the very first discourse, the Mahapadana Sutta. He says it's the same Dhamma which was taught by his predecessors, those who had become awakened, and he mentions Vipassi, who flourished 91 eons ago. What exactly an eon meant, I don't know at all. Whether one can put it in terms of years is a little bit doubtful. But it has its own meaning, it had its own meaning anyway for that time. And he mentions Sikhi, who flourished 31 eons ago. And also Vesabhu, who flourished at that same period. Their jati, that is social rank, jati is a peculiar word, it doesn't mean only birth, but it also means a conditioned state, it also means social rank. To this day we use the word jati, we inquire from a person whom we haven't met before, what jati he is. What is his caste, in other words, you see, and so forth. Their jati was noble. They came from the Kshatriya group. The next three, who flourished in the same aeon as Gautama himself, were Brahmins. Kakusanda, Konagamana, and Kassapa. Gautama himself was born a noble. But note that Gautama affirms he is a Brahman. It's very important to take notice of these things. And you know that the last canto of the Dhammapada is called the Brahmanavagga, and he describes who is a true Brahman. But see what he says in the Itivuttaka. This was said by the Exalted One. So I have heard. Monks, I am a Brahman, one to ask a favor of, ever clean-handed, incomparable physician and surgeon. He says outright, I am a Brahman. Now, one has to notice an important point here. The word Brahman in that context, and in the context of the Upanishadic teachers, and in their time, did not mean merely being member of a particular social group called the Brahmins. Did not mean that at all. If you study the Vajrasuchi Upanishad carefully, you will see it stated clearly and unequivocally that whosoever has realized Brahman, he, whatever his social group may have been, he is a true Brahman. A Brahman is the Brahma realized, the Brahma become, the Brahma Bhuta. And the Buddha himself says that Brahma Bhuta is a term which applies to him. Then again, there is a reference to him as a Brahman in the Majjhima Nikaya, the first volume, Majjhima 109, where a Sakyan, who is described as the Sakyan stick in hand, Dandapani, because he always went about with a stick in his hand. He talks to him, and then after the conversation is over, one of the Buddha's bhikkhus refers to the Buddha himself this way. He says, what did that man want to find out from the Lord, that Brahman? The bhikkhu himself refers to the Buddha as that Brahman. And then again, in the Vammika Sutta, you'll find it in the first volume of the Majjhima, the Buddha gives one of his wonderful parables and so forth, and then he explains the meaning of the terms that he uses. And he says outright there, Brahman is a synonym for Tathagata. Now one should take note of these things, because to me it is, of course this is personal to me only, to me it is a sorrowful thing that there has been this sort of cleavage between conventional orthodox Buddhism and the Vedic Upanishadic teachings. I don't think that there is the slightest ground for any cleavage, any disharmony between the two. This eternal law that the Buddha talks of, the Dhamma, was taught long before his time by Zarathustra in Bactria. The language used there was Avastan, and the term used for the Dhamma is Asha. Now this word Asha underwent several modifications. It became Arsh, Eresh, Artha, and then Ereta. Now the Avastan Ereta is the equivalent of the Rig Vedic Ritta. That is, the eternal law, the law which is inherent in everything and every being throughout the universe, the law of his being. It's something which is very difficult to put into words. And in fact, in the Rig Veda itself, I'll read that out to you later on. In the Rig Veda itself, there are only four verses which deal directly with Ritta and its significance. Now, how do we apprehend this eternal law? Do we not apprehend it as so many words and concepts, the rules of good conduct, the meditative exercises, the laws of karma, of causal origination, samudayo and nirodho, of ill, the paticca-samuppada, etc., etc.? Is not all this a mass of words intended to communicate something which it is our business to understand? But do we understand? What is understanding? Literally, to stand under. That is understanding. To stand under. To be the foundation, in other words. The root, the source, which to us as we are at present is the unknown and unknowable by intellect, by feeling, by perception, or by intuition. Please distinguish between intuition and unerring insight. Nous, the nous of the Greeks, Plato and all that group. Buddhi in India, that was mistranslated, I think, even in this century by Dr. E.J. Thomas, when he translated Buddhi as intellect. It's not intellect. Buddhi is unerring insight, which is totally different. That unerring insight has no relationship with our vijnanic activity, our discriminative consciousness in action, with the brain at work. It is because the person gets that, even if it is a momentary touch with the transcendent context of the infinite and the eternal, then he has that flash, which is unerring insight. That is the truth. So I don't like the use of the word intuition time and again in so many contexts. Now, regarding the senses, regarding Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara, what did the Buddha say about them all? They are anicca, that is anitya, the Sanskrit form, which means not eternal. Anicca means not eternal. It's usually translated as impermanent. But I think if we say not eternal, if we regard it as not eternal, we can get much more deeply into the real meaning of anicca. It's dukkha. And the fundamental meaning of the word dukkha, you'll find this in Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, far from the infinite. The infinite made bad, spoiled. It is anatta, not atma, not ultimate reality, not paramartha satya, the supreme truth. Therefore, with wisdom, put them aside. That's what the Buddha taught. The whole of the existential being, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, discriminative consciousness, put it aside. How do we put that aside? Suppose I have just bitten an apple which is rotten. I can throw away that apple into the dustbin, spit out what is in my mouth, spit out in the right place, otherwise I'd be fined several pounds, wouldn't I? And wash my mouth clean. I can't do that. I can't throw away Vedna, Sanya, Sankara, because this existential being named Firoz Mehta is Rupa, Vijnana, etc. This is the existential being. It's the existential being who has this name. I can't cast aside all my existentiality, excepting by the destruction of the whole existential being, from Rupa to Vijnana. And before Sammasambodhi, the word I specifically represents Rupa to Vijnana, the existential being. That's what the word I represents. If you look very carefully into your own processes, your own mental processes and so forth, trying to find the I, you will discover that on the whole, you are identifying it with some aspect or other, and only some aspect or other, of the existential being. That is what the word I represents for us as we are. This existential being is the miserable space-time perisher. All this is therefore the very stuff of avidya. What then is vidya, vidya? What is Sammasambodhi? Did not Siddhartha Gautama seek and be integrated into the word in the Majjhima Nikaya? Is he one? I prefer to put it this way, that he was integrated into the unborn, unaging, undying, unsorrowing, unstained. How can you win that which is transcendence? You can't win it. You can win something which is finite, temporal, which is limited, which belongs to the realm of dukkha. You can win that. A prize, a medal, etc., etc. You can't win the transcendent. Besides, that type of formulation is somewhat self-centered, isn't it? I won the transcendent. I had God come down to tea with me on Thursday afternoon. It's as nonsensical as that. So I prefer to use the word, you put it this way, that he sought and he was integrated into the transcendent, liberated out of the finite, the temporal and the mortal context. And this took place by the utter purification and transmutation of that bundle of aggregates, Rupa to Vijnana, named Siddhartha by his parents and by the world to this day. That transmutation spelt the utter dissolution of any identification exclusively with any constituent of the mortal existential being. Let us imagine a little bit. Can you imagine, in relation to the mortal Siddhartha, how his mother, Queen Mahamaya, for about 7 days only, and his aunt, Mahaprajapati, who after Queen Mahamaya's death became his foster mother, and how his father, for several years, must have fondled this child and said to him 1,000 times, "Come to mummy, or come to daddy, Siddhi darling." Just try and imagine that situation. I can remember myself how, as an infant, I used to run up to my mother and thrust my face into her bosom and be enfolded in her arms, and how blissful it was. And then, as a little boy, when I was grown up, when father came home from work, I would run up to him and jump into his arms, and he would twirl me around. He was a big and strong man, and do all sorts of wonderful things which made me laugh and have so much fun and happiness. Now, do not brush this aside as silly sentimentality. Do not despise this, for it is in such simple soil that love germinates. If rightly nurtured, it can blossom into the Mahakaruna of a Buddha. But the seed is sown in infancy. Remember, the delicate perfection and the exquisite perfume of the loveliest rose marks the culmination of an emergence out of clay, just common clay. It was this darling Siddhi, grown to princely, trained boyhood, grown to tender compassionateness, who took the wounded swan pierced in the wing by his cousin Devadatta's arrow, rested it on his lap, soothed it and healed it. When Devadatta claimed it as his prize, Siddhartha refused to deliver it by right of mercy and love's lordliness. It was this boy, now knowing that he was to teach compassion to a woe-begone world, who sat under the shade of a rose-apple tree and experienced the first jhana. This was a critical experience in the young boy's life, because he remembered this when he was practicing those austerities and found them fruitless. And he decided, he remembered this event and he thought, this perhaps is the way to Sammāsambuddhi. Then came marriage and a son, and thereafter the great going forth, after he saw a sick man, an old man, a corpse, and a mendicant. 6 years passed by, culminating in the Sammāsambuddhi. He had found the deathless. He had realized that transcendent consciousness. This finding is not a discovery by thinking, not a momentary insight, certainly not merely an ephemeral intuition, not a penetration by genius, not anything which is a put together, a compounded philosophic system, however subtle or transcendental. It is nothing which emerges as a product of the activity of the existential being. It is not imparted from outside and received by vijnana, discriminative consciousness. It is a complete transmutation of the existential being. Vijnana and its limitations no longer apply. Sanya and Sankhara are emptied. They are emptied of all the ideas, the beliefs, the thought forms and whatnot, all the confections, so to say. That's one of the meanings of the word Sankhara. Well, all the confections which obstruct the light of transcendence. So, when all those are emptied, the psyche is transparent. Void, empty, a non-obstructor of the transcendent light of truth. It is then that pure mind, and you remember what I said about pure mind yesterday, that archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy, which is the great formative influence in the evolution of the cosmos as such. The limited and disturbing sensitivity of Vedana is changed into the tranquil chord of communion, and the Rupa is still. silent. Vijnana is no longer vijnana, that is discriminative consciousness, but is pure, this is the Buddha's own phrase, but is pure vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam. Consciousness which is characterless, endless, therefore beginningless, everywhere shining. It's very important to take a phrase like this and meditate deeply on it. If you can ever sort of get a suitable situation, a quiet situation, an inspiring situation, just let the mind dwell quietly on the words and see what the words will reveal to you. Characterless. No qualifications, therefore not in the context of the finite, temporal and mortal. And he says, anantam, endless, whatsoever is endless, never had a beginning, therefore eternal, everywhere shining. Now the everywhere must not be interpreted spatially merely. Everywhere is just right here. In the transcendent context, there is no here or there or distance or separation at all. This is the extraordinary. The brain can never picture this. I have tried hard sometimes to sort of get a sort of a pictorial representation of it, but it is impossible. It just spoils it. When that sort of lightning of transcendence, the phrase I used yesterday, touches you, it never destroys you, but it enlightens you in a manner which totally negates the whole of the mortal context, of the finite and the temporal, without destroying that context. This is the very important thing. The world of dukkha is never destroyed. Dukkha goes on as long as consciousness is not evolved, has not come to its culmination out of the finite and temporal, into the infinite and the eternal. So that just goes on because it is the necessary stimulus for growth. Vijnana, yes. Now this phrase, vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam, is the Buddha's equivalent, the exact equivalent of the Upanishadic Atma, of the Pali Atta. That is the real meaning of Atma. You study the Upanishads carefully, particularly the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads, you will find this. And it is non-discriminative, it is non-separative, non-isolative. The fully self-awakened one no longer knows by any means belonging to the existential state, the finite, temporal, and mortal state. The fully self-awakened one does not see the truth, the Dhamma, as something objective perceived by him as the subject. He, the living, constant revelation, is the Dhamma. He understands, he sees, if we permit ourselves to use such existential terms, by being the Dhamma, being Brahma. So you see, this knowing by being, knowing, the word knowing just doesn't apply in that kind of context. You are that which you have realized as the truth. You are that thing. In consciousness and mind. In the Upanishads, the teachers just declared, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahma. I wish they would have put it the other way around and said, Brahman is me, instead of I am. The Buddha's context of functioning is transcendence from the moment of finding the deathless, from the moment of Sammasambuddhi. It is the context of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal, the deathless Amata which he had found, the Akalika eternal Dhamma of which he was the very body, the unfathomable, trackless, infinite Tathagatahood which was his. Siddhartha Gautama, the dewdrop, had slipped into the shining sea. And the whole of that shining sea, the perfected Holy One, the supremely self-enlightened Buddha, realized complete containment in that single, pure, divine dewdrop, Siddhartha Gautama. I'm using the word single not in the sense of a particular separate from other particulars, but I'm using the word single in the sense of wholeness, of completeness, of holiness in the true sense of the word. And the two, Gautama, Buddha, are one. If we can understand this, we will begin to see the true, the transcendent meaning of the word Atta, the word Atma. Then only will we understand the teaching of Anatta and appreciate the right use of that word in various contexts and its incorrect use in other contexts. Each one of us is a dewdrop whose potential is the shining sea. Let us fulfill our duty. Make that drop single, pure, divine. Now this figure of speech, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, is not exclusive to Buddhism. It is found in Jalaluddin Rumi, the great Islamic mystic, in his Divan and Masnavi. In Dante's Paradiso, the third canto, line 84. In Angelus Silesius. In Eckhart, when he talks of the sea of God's unfathomable nature, plunge in, this is the drowning which doesn't kill. And in China, where the Tao is the ocean to which all things return, in the Tao Te King, number 32, the last line reads, Tao in the world may be compared to rivers that run into the sea. It's very interesting how in all parts of the world where the realization takes place, you get similar modes of expression too. You may wonder why I use words like infinite, eternal, transcendence so freely. Consider quietly the Buddha's own use of such words. You know how very often throughout the discourses he repeats in detail the stages of the four jhanas and the four samapattis. And in dealing with the samapattis, we must remember that a samapatti is not just an attainment. The whole concept of attainment doesn't fit into that context at all. A samapatti actually is a coalescence. That which was limited has burst the bonds of all limitation and has coalesced with the totality. That is the state of the samapatti. And the first samapatti is he enters upon and abides in the plane of infinite akasha. Akasha is usually translated as space. But akasha is a very difficult word to put into any other language. At least I find it very difficult to put it into English in the proper way. I would have to use many sentences to suggest what is implied there. But bear in mind that the word akasha has its root kash, meaning to shine. Now, we know space only in the ordinary spatial sense, something which contains the cosmos. Does this box this container shine. But Akasha in itself is shining, because partly it is consciousness itself manifesting as the container. Consciousness and creative energy constricting by self-constriction produce space, time and all the rest of it. Produce the limited mortal sphere. So the Buddha talks of entering upon and abiding in infinite Akasha and infinite Vijnana. He uses the term infinite. Space which subsumes and interpenetrates the entire cosmos. Vijnana is linked with time. Vijnanic functioning is the temporal process. The functioning of our discriminative consciousness is the process in time. Pure or absolute consciousness made rather sluggish. Infinity of Akasha Vijnana means that all differentiation, all particular, that is atomic existence, has disappeared. Only an all-pervading universal field is constantly present. Eternal, hence deathless, immortal. It happens when Vijnana is stripped clean of all isolativeness and separativeness. This is what confines us to the realm of the mortal, the isolativeness and separativeness. That vanishes, and the subject-object duality vanishes. There is only unity consciousness, which precisely is the Atta, the Vijnanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbato Abham, the Atma of the Upanishads. Now, in connection with this word infinity, there is a very interesting little passage in the Chandogya Upanishad, which I trust will prove a little interesting. The disciple Narada approaches his teacher Sanat Kumara and asks him to expound by demonstrating Brahman. And Sanat Kumara asks Narada. Narada is one of the great yogis of his time. Tell me what you already know and I will tell you more. So Narada gives a recital of what he knows. Well, super encyclopedia. That is what Narada was. And Sanat Kumara says to him, "Oh, all that is mere name." And he leads him step by step through quite a long series of terms and states of mind and consciousness, and comes to the point where Sanat Kumara says, when one obtains happiness, one is active. He uses the word sukham in the text. He doesn't say ananda yet. Sukha, happiness, is something which belongs to the world of the finite. When one obtains happiness, then one is active. One who does not obtain happiness is not active. Only he who obtains happiness is active. But one must desire to understand happiness. And Narada says, "Venerable sir, I desire to understand happiness." He also uses that word sukha. Then Sanat Kumara answers, "The infinite is happiness. There is no happiness in anything small, the finite. Only the infinite, the immeasurable, the transcendent is happiness." And here Sanat Kumara still uses the word sukha. but one must desire to understand the infinite. Sir, I desire to understand the infinite. And then here, Sanat Kumara says, when one sees nothing else, hears nothing else, understands nothing else, that is the infinite, the immeasurable. All otherness, all elseness has disappeared altogether. There is only the absolute total reality, the one total reality. Then that is happiness, he says. Verily, the infinite is the same as the immortal. The finite is the same as the mortal. Venerable sir, on what is the infinite established? He asks a curious question. On what is the transcendent established? On its own greatness, or not even on its own greatness, says Sanat Kumara. And then he goes on, that infinite indeed is below, above, behind, in front. It is to the south, to the north of all the world. Now next, the instruction in regard to the self-sense. I indeed am below, above, behind, and in front. I am to the south. I am to the north. I indeed am all this world. Now this I is not the limited I with reference to the existential being. It is the one and only I am. You get the same teaching in the Kabbalah too. And you get it in Exodus chapter 3 verse 14 when the Lord God says to Moses out of the burning bush, when Moses asks, if the Israelites ask you, ask me, who hath sent you? Say unto them, Ehiye Asher Ehiye. I am that I am, the one and only I am in the universe. If Brahman were to say, utter the word I, the I there means Atma, the Atta, the ultimate. Now next, the instruction in regard to the Atma. The Atma is below, above, behind, front, to the south, to the north. The Atma indeed is all this world. Verily, he who sees this, who understands this, he has pleasure in the self. He has delight in the self. He has union in the Atma. He has joy in the Atma. He is independent. He has unlimited freedom in all worlds, and so forth. And when he's saying this, he Sanat Kumara finally does use the word Ananda. He says Atma Ananda. He doesn't use the word Sukha anymore, which belongs to the temporal context. This is the transcendent, eternal context, the Ananda. And you know, of course, in Buddhism we have the word, in the Buddhist texts we have the word Ananda. Ananda is that ineffable, peaceful bliss which has no possible description to it. It cannot be communicated by one to another. It can... you can, if and when you become that other in mind and consciousness, your Ananda enfolds that other in it altogether. In the presence, you know, in the theistic religions, in the presence of God, there is that peace which passes all understanding. All understanding. So, that is the infinite. So, thus we see that the infinity of Akasha Vijnana means that consciousness is functioning in the mode of immortality, in the context of the infinite eternal. And the Buddha himself says, it's in the Udana, the 8th chapter, I think. He says, hard is the infinite to see. Truth is no easy thing to see. Well, we'll stop there today and continue tomorrow.